It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new set of education recommendations were the focus of a recent bipartisan meeting in the state capitol. We'll talk to a public policy expert about what the future of education could look like here in Wisconsin.
First, it's been a busy week in Washington as President Trump nears his 100th day in office amid a tug of war between lawmakers as the GOP tries to make good on campaign promises on health care, foreign policy, and tax reform.
Joining us now to recap the biggest stories from the Capitol is Scott Wong. He's a senior reporter for The Hill, focusing on House Speaker Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with, let's start with health care part two, Scott. Of course, there was the highly publicized non-vote on health care earlier. There's talk this week, members of the House Republican caucus there coming close to a deal. What are we seeing from them?
Well, that's right. We did see the original GOP health care bill crash and burn last month in a spectacular fashion. That bill appears to be back from the dead. Centrist Republicans have teamed up with the far-right Freedom Caucus and struck a deal to amend that bill. Basically, it would give states more flexibility and choice in deciding to opt out of certain Obamacare requirements. Now, Speaker Paul Ryan is saying, look, there's no guarantee that we have the 216 votes needed to pass this thing yet. We feel like we're getting close, but until we reach that threshold, we will not bring this to the floor. And so right now, the Freedom Caucus, the conservatives, have signed on to this deal. They say they're prepared to bring over plenty of votes. They had been holdouts in the past, so now all eyes are on the moderates. And so far, many of the moderates are remaining quiet, saying they're still reviewing the details.
And, Scott, what do we know about how Democrats might be receiving this?
Well, Democrats are saying this is a non-starter from the very beginning. And so that's why this proved to be so tricky the first time, because Democrats said they would not provide any votes. They are in it 100% to try to protect Obamacare, prevent Republicans from trying to gut it. And so they are supplying zero votes for this repeal and replace effort, which means it's all on the Republicans and all on Donald Trump.
So that's a repeal and replace effort, but it's going on during this debate over a continuing resolution on spending, basically extending the current budget to keep the government open. And the health care plan, Obamacare, came up in that. This exchange deal, maybe more defense spending, Democrats say they'd sign off on in exchange for Obamacare subsidies. So what are we saying? This is a moving target, as I understand it. What are we seeing right now?
Right. If Congress does not pass a spending bill, the government will shut down early Saturday morning. That's when funding will run out. And so we are starting with just days to go. We are starting to see the contours of a deal emerge. Basically, Democrats have agreed to give Donald Trump $15 billion in additional military spending. That's about half of what he asked for, the $30 billion. And in exchange, Republicans and the White House say we will continue to make payments on these Obamacare subsidies that help low-income individuals who are on Obamacare. And so that's sort of the deal that we're starting to hear emerge yesterday and today. Because the deadline is coming up so quickly, what GOP aides and lawmakers are telling me is that likely they will need a short-term continuing resolution, just a one-week bill to sort of bridge the gap as they finish off the final details of this agreement. And so we're likely to be talking about this spending fight well into next week.
But Scott, if the GOP doesn't go for that deal, that leaves the healthcare exchanges on the ropes, and who's on the hook for that if they falter?
Well, right now, it's unclear. Right now, Democrats are saying we don't exactly trust Donald Trump. Donald Trump and the White House are giving their word that these subsidies will be taken care of and fully funded. But there is some skepticism from Democrats. I heard from Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, the number three Democratic leader who is very skeptical of the White House and whether they will be able to live up to this promise. Obviously, Republicans, while they are making this promise, are also in another effort trying to gut the Obamacare health law in its entirety. So you can understand why there is some distrust between Democrats and this White House.
Scott Wong is with us, senior reporter for The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Scott, before we move on from that continuing resolution, President Trump said, hey, fund the wall in the continuing resolution. Looks like they're not going to do that. What's the latest on the wall?
Well, that's right. We've been receiving a lot of mixed signals from the White House and from the president on this border wall. Remember, this was one of the top campaign promises that Donald Trump made. And basically, you know, last weekend, White House officials said we are insisting that money for the wall be included in this funding bill. But since then, Donald Trump has backed off and says maybe we can do this in September and punt it to the fall. And that really was a major sticking point that was taken off the table, clearing the way for the government to be funded. That was a big deal and a big sigh of relief on Capitol Hill.
We're talking to Scott Wong right now, senior reporter for The Hill, looking at the latest in national politics. And Scott, the entire Senate is going to be going to the White House to be briefed on North Korea by the senior administration, maybe Donald Trump appearing for a little while. How unusual is this?
It's very unusual. In fact, one of the lawmakers, Roy Blunt of Missouri, said the last time he could remember such a briefing where all 100 senators, Democrats and Republicans, went over to the White House was back in 2009 during the health care debate. And he actually said that these types of briefings are not very helpful. But, you know, obviously Donald Trump, this is on his turf, his territory. And he's trying to show leadership. He's trying to show he's being presidential in standing up to the threats, the nuclear threats from North Korea. And so I guess this is one way that he can do it. He's a man who understands the stage, how you stage things, optics. And so this is, I think, you know, this is somebody who understands television as well. And so we're going to see a lot of images probably out of the White House of White House officials and the president looking presidential as he discusses the North Korea threat.
Yeah, it seems like there's some confusion here. Is this really important and we're going to see some kind of big policy announcement, or is this just a flare for the theatrical and maybe a bit of a power move saying, no, you come to my place and I'm going to talk to you here?
Yeah, I'm not entirely clear what's going to come of this. Typically, these types of meetings are held in secure classified briefing rooms in the basement of the Capitol. There's one on both the Senate side and the House side that can accommodate these types of large crowds. So these are highly unusual, and you know, it's my sense that this is more theatrical, although obviously the threat from North Korea is very real.
Right. I mean, does this say something about rising tensions with North Korea, and no matter what the optics are, a serious situation?
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing about you know, military moving ships, you know, positioning ships in just, you know, outside of Korea, and obviously with the intention of protecting some of our closest allies in South Korea and Japan. It's, you know, we've heard from the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, that you know, he wants to destroy America, that he's prepared to launch nuclear attacks on this country. And we've also heard the rhetoric from this side, from the Trump administration and from the president, saying he's prepared to preemptively strike if he feels that this threat is very real. So I expect that we're going to hear a lot more rhetoric in the coming days on North Korea.
We're recapping the biggest stories in national politics right now with Scott Wong, senior reporter for The Hill.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the president's outline of a tax policy, corporate tax cuts, substantial ones, along with some other tax cuts. What do you think of the president's new tax plan? What do you think should change? Should the tax code be simplified, taxes be cut, or are you worried about the impact on the deficit? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation with Scott Wong, senior reporter for The Hill, and we're recapping the biggest headlines in national politics this week.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's new tax plan? A one-page document, I understand, but outlining major corporate tax cuts in particular. Do you think this is a good idea? Boost the economy, ultimately pay for itself, or are you worried about the impact on the annual debt? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Scott, what do we know so far about what's contained in President Trump's tax plan?
Well, we know a few details. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is calling this plan, saying it will amount to the biggest tax cut in American history. It's mainly aimed at trying to simplify the tax code, obviously something that's very complicated, something that includes tax breaks for dozens of types of entities. It's just become very convoluted over the decades. And so some of the specifics we know, it will cut top income tax rates from 39.6% to down to 35%. It will double the standard deduction for taxpayers to $24,000. One of the key items in this tax plan, it's going to lower the corporate income tax rate as well as the rate for small businesses from 35 all the way down to 15%. And that, interestingly enough, has drawn some attention because that would also cover Trump's own real estate firm. So we know a few details. One big detail that I think we're still waiting for is how this thing gets paid for. That's something Democrats are pointing out, saying, the math doesn't add up. Trump has not laid out exactly how he's going to pay for this entire plan. And so that's something I think more details will be trickling out in the days to come.
And you use the word trickling there, and the idea of trickle-down economics seems to be coming up here. And the idea that we're going back to the days of the Laffer curve, supply-side economics, these tax cuts will produce more revenue. Ultimately, the lower tax rate will still pay for itself. A lot of budget watchers saying that doesn't really work out that way in practice. What's been the reaction to that supply-side idea?
Well, I think it's been very partisan, the reaction. Obviously, Democrats and Republicans view tax reform in very different ways and view taxes in very different ways. That is correct. I think Republicans believe that, by lowering taxes, it will help stimulate the economy and generate growth for the country. I think the biggest challenge as we look at this legislatively is we had so many problems with the health care bill that was supposed to be a breeze, right? That was the number one priority for Republicans on the campaign trail. They campaigned on that. They won the election saying that they were going to repeal health care, and they stumbled and have had real difficulty in getting it, not only through the Senate, which is a much heavier lift, but through the House of Representatives, where they control a majority and where you only need a simple majority to pass things. So I think a lot of people are anticipating similar challenges in trying to get such a complicated issue through the House of Representatives and then, of course, through the Senate, where things are just a lot more difficult.
And Scott, Paul Ryan has his own ideas about tax reforms. It's kind of his wheelhouse. How does what he wants square with what the president is asking for?
Well, he is very he was very praiseworthy of Donald Trump and his tax plan today. However, there is one glaring difference between the Ryan tax plan and the Donald Trump tax plan, and that is that the Trump plan does not include something called border adjustment tax, which is a critical element of the speaker's plan. It would impose a 20% tax on all imported goods coming to the United States. It was a way for Ryan, essentially, to pay for many of these tax cuts in lowering some of these tax rates. So I think the devil will be in the details, whether Trump will be able to figure out how to make this plan balance. Right now, there's still a lot of open questions. And so far, Speaker Ryan, who is a big policy wonk and the former chairman of both the Budget Committee and the Ways and Means Committee, who knows this stuff inside and out, so far, for now, he is deferring to Donald Trump in the White House to take the lead on tax reform.
Some Democrats have been saying, we don't want to touch tax reform until the president himself reveals his taxes so we know how these changes would impact him. Steve Mnuchin said, not going to happen. We're not going to be releasing the president's taxes. Is this still a hot issue in Washington?
You know, it's I wouldn't say it's a hot issue in Washington. Where I would say it's a hot issue is around the country. When I was over the Easter recess when Congress was out of town, I was up in New Jersey at a town hall for Representative Leonard Lance, a moderate Republican. And the first question out of the gate at that town hall was, will you call on Donald Trump to release his taxes? And so lawmakers are certainly feeling the pressure from their constituents to get on board and join the call for Donald Trump to release his taxes. Leonard Lance, what he said was he supports the idea of Donald Trump releasing his taxes, but he does not think Congress should mandate that Donald Trump release his taxes. So there's a fine detail there.
And Scott, we have a question from a listener named David who asks, who's going to benefit the most from these proposed tax cuts and who's going to bear the brunt of the deficit? Do we have answers to that yet?
That's a tough question. I'm not a tax guy myself. But, I mean, if you believe the Republican philosophy, that this tax plan will sort of lift all boats, that it will jumpstart the economy, that it will, produce jobs, continue helping the stock market, continue helping the economy grow. And so that's sort of the argument that Republicans are making at the moment. It's hard to figure out how exactly, how exactly certain Americans at different income levels will benefit without seeing more details.
Looking at the latest national news with Scott Wong, senior reporter from The Hill. Let's bring in a caller on this tax cut issue. Tony is with us in Tomahawk. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, several things, actually.
Give us just one or two of them.
Well,
short on time.
When Kennedy said it's going to lift all boats, and Donna Shalala said, no, it's the latest one, the Reagan one, and the Bush ones are going to lift all yachts. The whole fiction of that the corporate tax rate is 35%, it isn't. It's effectively 25%. And a lot of corporations pay zero tax. And if that can't be said, then we're just not giving people the complete story. The other thing is that this is going to blow up the deficit. Absolutely. It did under Reagan. It did under both Bushes. And if Republicans are listening, two-thirds of the national debt are directly responsible to the Republican administrations. If you factor in the interest on the national debt, two-thirds of this $19 trillion is really from Republican administrations.
Tony, thanks for the call. And that effective corporate tax rate is an issue. We're seeing Republicans saying, or the Donald Trump plan saying, we're going to lower this tax rate, but we are going to cut these loopholes that are letting companies get out of paying taxes. It seems like it still adds up to a bigger deficit unless other offsets are found. Is that right, Scott?
Well, that's what's interesting about a lot of these plans that we're seeing from Donald Trump. He's talked about infrastructure, which is, a big spending plan. Certainly, this tax reform plan right now, it looks as though it would add to the deficit, although it has not been scored yet by CBO. But I think Republicans on Capitol Hill, at least the last few terms, have been very focused like a laser on spending issues. And it's very interesting to see how they are reacting to some of these plans that actually call for more spending and are actually increasing the deficit.
Scott, I want to look at one more story from this week before we finish up. Ivanka Trump was in Germany on a panel with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, other women leaders, and during that time she called her father a champion for families and got some boos and hisses from the audience. What was the point of friction there?
Yeah, I mean, I think wherever any of the Trump family members go, they are going to encounter protesters. She was invited by German Chancellor Merkel, whom she got to know during Merkel's recent visit to the White House. They actually sat together at an event, and so Merkel, invited Ivanka Trump to come out to Berlin and join in a women's event. Obviously, you know, the backdrop of this type of event and the reason why there were boos and hisses, I think, is that Trump has had a lot of questions about his treatment of women, especially that emerged during the campaign in light of that 2005 Access Hollywood tape that surfaced on the campaign trail in which he was openly bragging about inappropriately touching women. And so those questions continue to swirl above the president. And Ivanka Trump is seen as somebody who is sort of a moderating force on the president. And I think it's very deliberate that she's out in public as sort of an ambassador for not only, the White House, but for Donald Trump himself, in a way that shows that he values women, that he values women's opinions. And the White House has been very quick to point out that Trump, during his real estate days, had many female executives who he promoted through the years. And so that's something that they're highlighting as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks for joining us again.
Okay, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior reporter for The Hill. He joined us for our regular Week in Washington segment when we recap the biggest stories in national politics. Education is a hot-button issue nationwide, and people can't seem to reach a consensus over the best way to educate American children.
But a recent report from a bipartisan group of lawmakers outlined some actionable steps that could be taken to level the playing fields for students across the country and at home in Wisconsin.
Alan Borsuk joins us now to talk about the report and what might need to change in order to provide Wisconsin students the best education available. He's a fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University and an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Here.
Well, talk about this report. A bipartisan group of lawmakers. These are people from around the country. Bipartisan and education don't always go hand in hand, as you point out in your piece. But what were they trying to tackle here?
Well, the whole enterprise, which almost nobody tackles anymore. I think a few years ago there was much more of a sense of education being a bipartisan undertaking, and that's just not so true anymore. But this is the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is exactly that, a bipartisan group. And one of the leaders in the group on its education work is Senator Luther Olson, who is the chairman of the Wisconsin State Senate Education Committee and longtime legislator with a strong interest in education. So Senator Olson played a big role in this report. And it kind of calls, in my mind, for going back to a few years ago when there was more of a consensus on trying to raise the bar nationally, trying to get everyone to get on board. And some of that broke down over Obama issues, and some of it broke down over the Common Core standards. But it definitely broke down, so it's kind of a call to go back to that, in my mind.
And you reported on, there was a presentation, an event, a lot of presenters in Wisconsin. Set the scene for us.
Well, the Wisconsin School Administrators Alliance, which is exactly that, kind of representatives of a bunch of public school administrators, school board members, different organizations involved in education, hosted a group. It was pretty much an invitation event, although it wasn't exactly a closed event, in Madison, must be 2.5 weeks ago now, to look at this report. Senator Olson was involved in the session. They brought in a fairly well-known national think tank kind of guy on this named Mark Tucker, who has an organization called the National Center on Economics and Education. I think I got that right. National Center on Education and the Economy, that's what it is. And he was the keynote speaker. And he had a number of prescriptions for what do we do if we're really serious about teaching and reaching all the kids in the state, and a lot of them don't have to do with just the state budget and politics and money, which is what we spend so much of our time on around here.
And it seems like the main point, the first step, is a sense of urgency, and this report is titled No Time to Lose. And is that the attitude you're getting for people involved? Hey, whatever we do, we need to start doing something now?
I laugh only because, no, that's not really the sense you get from talking to people, especially in the political world and who are working on the bigger scene or on community-wide politics. And that's especially true, frankly, when you're dealing with the highest need kids, and not only in the city of Milwaukee, but in a lot of the cities around the state and in a lot of the rural areas, that you say, hey, come on, folks, let's get moving. And you get a lot of talk, but not too much action. So if this report is aimed at building some urgency, personally, I think that's a call that should be listened to, but I'm not so optimistic that there'll be much response in the big picture.
You picked out some of the main themes from the report and from this meeting in a piece you wrote recently. And one of the things that came out of this is kids who only have basic skills are in deep trouble. Can you talk about that?
Well, this Mark Tucker, very interesting fellow, and he said basically a lot of kids nationwide, and he very much applied this to Wisconsin, are being put in line as far as the quality of their education for jobs that are going to be low-paying, not terribly secure, not really part of a thriving overall economy, including in Wisconsin, because they just aren't going to have the sophisticated tools. It's not just computer education. It's a whole involvement in problem solving and work skills and flexibility and a whole set of character traits that come with this. And that's what you're seeing in other countries in the world that are passing the United States or have rated above the United States for a number of years. And the most prominent international gauges of this, that their students are coming out of school just way more prepared for the future of the economy of the world than American kids are as a whole.
Talking to Alan Borsuk about his recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some recent calls to action when it comes to education in Wisconsin and around the country. So, Alan, what do we do about that? If we're training too many kids with just that basic level of skills, and we've seen this in the news a lot, the job market is training those kind of jobs. If they're around, they're not going to pay very well. How can we change education to meet that?
Well, I think some of the things you'd hear from people, not only Mark Tucker, but others who are into this, doing more to ensure that kids are ready for school when they reach kindergarten. There are just so many kids who are not getting the early childhood experiences that could really benefit them and build character, build intellectual awareness. And we're talking about one-year-olds and two-year-olds and not just four-year-old kindergarten. So having kids arrive at kindergarten ready to be part of a school experience, knowing how to behave, knowing how to listen to people and doing, I hear for this from teachers all the time, how off track their kids are, even at the kindergarten level. One is setting and really meaning high standards for kids, a little more ambitious than we've been in so many schools. And a third one, which is hugely important, is dealing with the future of teaching, the supply of teachers, the quality of teachers, the quality of teaching In much more meaningful ways than we've been doing up to this point.
You just listed three things there that are pretty huge. I want to take them one at a time.
Yeah, let's no talk problem. About, just go at it.
Let's talk about arriving ready at school. So this is, you're saying kids, before they're even in the schooling process, are in some ways falling behind. You write that some of the experts say other countries are doing a lot better on this than we are in the United States. What do other people do differently?
Well, I think they have broader, deeper early childhood programs, and more help to parents, more home visits, more involvement with making sure kids are on track. In a report from Mark Tucker's organization, he said in a lot of these high-performing countries in Europe and Asia, if the parents aren't going to do the job, the state finds ways to do it. And that's a pretty tall order, and obviously the best thing is if kids get really rich, good experiences as children at home, but there's so many kids that's not happening for, and it's not only in the lowest end of the economic spectrum. In New York City, the mayor announced this week that they went to four-year-old kindergarten for all in the last couple of years, and now he wants to go to three-year-old kindergarten for all, which may be hard to implement, but it's a level of ambition that I'm not seeing in too many places.
And this is the United States. I could see a lot of pushback to this idea of schools, the government intruding further and further into families and parenting. Is there something about American culture that just makes that really unlikely?
Oh, I bet you're right about that. We're a country that prides itself on individualism and on the state not meddling, and that's certainly the controlling sentiment in Washington these days as far as the Trump administration. And I don't want to get too partisan about this, but my response would be, look at the realities of the kids who are arriving at five-year-old or four-year-old kindergarten and how their reading scores are when they get to third grade or so, which is considered a huge marker. If you can read well by the time you're in third grade, you're on track to do well. Well, we have a really huge number of kids in Wisconsin who are not meeting that standard. I believe it's more than 50% of all kids in the state are not rated as proficient in reading at the third grade level.
We're talking to Alan Borisuk. He's a fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He's an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And you can join our conversation. What changes would you like to see come to the education system here in Wisconsin? If you're a teacher or an administrator, what do you think needs to change? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about a recent report discussed this week by Wisconsin lawmakers that might shape future education policy in Wisconsin. Alan Borisuk is our guest. He's a fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take to get more people into teaching? We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Do you think that the state government, that schools should do more earlier for kids, starting with kids aged 3 or 2, maybe earlier, I don't know. What do you think the education needs to do to keep up with the times when it comes to skills kids are going to need to have good, reasonably stable, and well-paying jobs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alan, you were just talking about reading standards. That reminds me, another thing you mentioned was the need for high standards that some of these experts are citing. It seems like we've been trying to do that lately, right?
Oh, you make me sigh.
I get that a lot.
Yeah. No, I sigh because that's what the Common Core movement was supposed to do. If you go back 7 years or so, the whole Common Core initiative, which related to the ambitions and goals for kids learning, had two principles. One was to raise the bar, that we weren't aiming high enough perhaps anywhere in the country. And number two was to make it more consistent across the country. At that time, if you were rated as proficient in Wisconsin, that didn't mean you were going to be rated as proficient in, say, Massachusetts, which clearly had a higher standard. And you say, well, what does it mean if you're in Kansas or Louisiana or whatever? So the goal of this, which had very widespread report, much of it support, much of it from business groups, the National Governors Association, generally conservative organizations, the National Chamber of Commerce, was to do these two things. Well, then you get to actually having these standards. They become politically highly controversial, and then I'd even say toxic, and the whole movement seems to have kind of broken down. So that notion of raising the bar and having clear understandings, I just don't think it's as healthy now as it was a few years ago.
Let's bring on our callers now. Nate is with us in Middleton. Nate, hi.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to make three quick points. First of all, I'm an educator and I've been involved in education my whole lifetime, retired now. In the 90s, there was a strong push in a number of public schools to provide basically from infants to gate 12 an intervention on behalf of parents and young children, starting with notifying a parent as soon as their child was born, that the school system was there and had some resources to help them. And that led to, of course, preschool programming, et cetera. That kind of went away, and I think part of it was political will. Another point was, during that era, after many years, there was a strong push to have reading specialists in every school system, and every school system had one. The recent gubernatorial action has taken reading specialists away, and that's really interesting in light of what the speaker said about 50% of the children having problems with reading.
Nate, thanks for bringing up those points. I want to bring Alan in on those. The idea is that something people are trying to revive, home visits, early contact between schools and new parents, Alan?
Well, I think there are some efforts like that, and I'm glad there are, and I know of some in Milwaukee where I live that are really well-structured and I hope having good impact, but they don't measure up to the breadth of the problem. Just look at the state of kids coming into schools. And I'd agree that there was schools had deeper staffs 10 years ago in Wisconsin, and this is true statewide, and reading specialists were one of the things that kind of went out as staffs were tightened up. Were they having as much impact as was hoped? Frankly, that depended a lot on what was going on in a particular school, so maybe some of them weren't having so much impact. But I think there was more push specifically around early reading skills, early literacy, and up to and through third grade a few years ago, including, frankly, Governor Walker had a task force on this in his first 2 years as governor, and you just don't hear that much about it. So I think there was more push a few years ago than there is now, and that's regrettable because the problem hasn't gotten better.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to David on the line in Slinger. David, hi.
Hi, yes. I agree with pretty much everything I've heard. But it's really a shame that teachers are almost vilified in our culture, in our society, when they are so important. And many of them get paid less than what we would pay a babysitter for the same number of kids for the same number of hours that they're sitting in there, and yet we entrust our kids to be educated by these people.
David, thanks for the call. And Alan, that reminds me of another point that you had alluded to earlier, the teacher pipeline, bringing new teachers into the profession, a cause for concern right now, is it?
Well, for sure, and it's a cause on two scores. One is there's already shortages in some specific school districts, and to some degree this is worse out in the more rural parts of Wisconsin than in the more urban parts, and there's shortages in specific areas especially, which would include high school math and science, bilingual education, special education. But a second point is that the total pool is getting smaller. Enrollment in teacher preparation programs at colleges is down nationwide. It's down a lot in Wisconsin. Many people around here point to Act 10, the great public union civil war of 2011 as a reason, which may be true, except that the numbers are about the same in a lot of states that didn't do this. So the supply is tightening up. Is it because teachers are being vilified? Certainly a lot of teachers feel that way. And there's reasons to say that, but I mean, if you did a poll and asked people, do you like teachers, the answer would be yes, overwhelmingly. But are you doing things that show you really mean what you're saying? That wouldn't be so true, especially, you might argue, in the political realm.
Talking to Alan Borsuk from Marquette University Law School, and he's an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at education in Wisconsin. Back to our callers now. Mary is on the line in Clear Lake. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just have a comment that I've been teaching 34 years. I love what I do, and I'm very into it. And I noticed that the rigor of the last 5 years with all the testing has really stressed kids out, especially in the early years when we don't get to have playtime in kindergarten. And I think it has affected the creativity of the student. I think that's always been the United States' big calling, is that we have creative problem-solving types of kids. And I think data shows that by sixth grade, even though we're behind in some areas, that it is a wash. And I think we need our traditional kindergarten and maybe education with the parents on just to teach the children how to sit at the table and have, you know, they're not coming in with those basic polite skills anymore.
Mary, thanks for the call. A couple points there. Do we crush creativity in our drive for high standards and accountability and measurement, Alan?
I bet there's arguments for saying that in places and schools where that's been true. That I would separate the two. Is it the rigor or is it the testing or is it both? I think it might not be the rigor, but it might be the demands that are put on kids and teachers to produce data, which I think there's some movement back from how much that's been emphasized, and I hope that's helpful. You know, when my first daughter was getting ready to go to school many years ago, I said I want her to work hard and I want her to have a good time. And I don't think it's impossible to have schools that do that. Frankly, we were lucky. I think that was the kind of school she was in. So to have that joy and creativity doesn't necessarily compromise having ambitious, rigorous programs. It's an environment as a whole. So I don't think it's impossible to do both.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Alan, I don't know if I've talked to you about this before, but back in the Tommy Thompson administration, when you had a big fundamental structural problem, the governor would appoint a blue ribbon commission, he'd call it, with academic experts and people in the field, citizens, I think, legislators, things like that. They'd come together, try to set aside partisan differences, and come to the plate and try to create solutions. Is that something that could happen in 2017?
Something that could happen? I certainly it could happen. I don't think it will. It's just not the way things happen now, and maybe that's regrettable. I mean, I'm old. I remember Warren Knowles and Patrick Lucy having big task force on state government, on structures of education. You go back a long time, and there have been a lot of task force, some of which were, of course, not very productive, but some of which really transformed major functions in the state, like the higher education system. It's such a non-bipartisan world. You know, having everybody work together is such a challenge. And this is, frankly, I think, true on both sides of the spectrum. So a good task force has to be really a broad range of people, and that's really hard to get a broad range of people working together.
Well, you were at this meeting, No Time to Lose. I mean, did you see people in this crowd who might be able to do something like that to get together and start tackling some of these ideas in a positive
way?
Well,
certainly the organizers hoped that, and there were Republican and Democratic legislators there, a handful, and there were business people there, people from the education sector, some foundation people and such. But they were mostly people who were bought into the premise already that we all ought to work together and really try to get back to focusing on what can make a difference in the success of kids. So that was 60 or 70 people. How do you spread that to a much wider audience? How do you get traction, as one of the organizers put it to me? And they certainly hope to, but I think it's going to be a big undertaking.
We'll leave it there for now. Alan, thanks, as always, for joining us.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for listening.
We've been talking about education in Wisconsin with Alan Borsuk, fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He was with us to talk about education in Wisconsin. He's written about this for a long time at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Today is National Pretzel Day, celebration of the bready, salty treat in all its delicious and various forms.
And you were pointing out earlier, it seems like pretzels are having a moment. Pretzel rolls at stores, which I don't know if those are technically pretzels.
My
I'll say
kids
they are.
Love them.
Yeah. And homemade pretzels, I guess, at restaurants now. It's like those, you take the simple, basic thing and fancy it up for your fancy restaurant. So there's fancy pretzels coming up, homemade pretzels at restaurants.
Homemade pretzels are really
delicious.
Have you had them recently?
Not lately, no.
They come out, they're nice and warm, and they've got that saltiness on them. I think they're not so easy to make. I've tried to make them on my own, and they tasted like pretzels, like homemade pretzels, but they looked like yesterday's Cheerios in a bowl, still with the milk in them. They were not attractive.
My thing with pretzels is I like them. If there's pretzels there, I'll eat them. It's like iced tea. If you got that, I'll drink it. I'm never thinking, man, oh man, I could go for pretzels
really?
Right now.
Who doesn't want a pretzel? Wait, are you thinking of the crunchy pretzel
either
twist?
Any pretzel.
Not the soft baked pretzel?
No, I mean, those are good. And if you handed one to me right now, I would eat it and, you know, sound bad talking into the microphone. But I'm like, I'm not going to go out of my way. I'll go out of my way for many treats on this earth. Not pretzels.
Rob, you are not like the others. We need to make you a pretzel convert.
A pretzel connoisseur? Is that such a thing? I hope not.
It's a convert, but you could be a connoisseur too.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.